The following is a production of Vanderbilt's Owen Graduate School of Management. For more information about Owen, please visit owen.vanderbilt.edu.
It's great to be here. I'm going to do a few things today with you. And what I want you to do is, if you have questions at any time while I'm speaking, please raise your hand and ask them. I don't think it works where I speak for 40 minutes or 45 minutes, and then we leave 5 minutes for questions at the end, and somebody that definitely doesn't get their question answered. So feel free to interrupt and just raise your hand, and we'll answer the questions that you have right then and there. I'll give you a little background on myself first. Once I've done that, I think I'd like to talk about a couple issues that face the Predators here in Nashville, as well as some issues that face the National Hockey League overall in North America and even the world. And then finally, I think the topic that you're all most interested in is, how do you get a job in sports, or how do you apply what you're doing within the world of sports? And I find that that's the most important thing to people like yourselves who are working, going to school, and looking to advance your careers in different areas. You're not here to listen about me or maybe what I've done, but what you can do and what opportunities lie ahead for you. Just as a matter of background again, I grew up in Boston, born there, grew up there, played hockey all through high school, played hockey at Boston College. Was not as accomplished a player at Boston College as I was in high school. Back in Boston College, my first 2 years I dressed for two games. My sophomore year I dressed for a game against University of Massachusetts Lowell. Wasn't a big game. We were ahead 6-2 or 7-2 and won by a big score. And after the first period, I didn't get a shift. So we're in the locker room second period. Thinking, well, the game's not close. I'll probably get out there this period. Second period, not even a sniff. I never saw the ice. Third period, no ice time. So after the game, I go to our coach, who's actually one of the winningest coaches in college hockey history, Len Sedlarski, older guy at the time. And I went up to my coach. 3 periods, my friends, my family are all in the stands. I don't dress a lot of games. I didn't get a shift the whole game. What's going on? He looked at me and said, Mike, I tried. Every time I wanted to put you on the ice, he said, we were either killing a penalty, we were on the power play, or it was 5-on-5. So it was about that point in my sophomore year that I decided I better do something with my education, the education I received at Boston College, and try to apply my education and my skills to my passion, which was not only sports, but more particularly hockey. I was a double major at Boston College, English and Communications, and I had 7 roommates my senior year of college. Every one of them signed a National Hockey League contract. Without going any further, obviously, I didn't have a chance to do that. What I did was I approached the National Hockey League office in New York at the time, as I graduated, and asked for an internship. Received an internship in New York, went down for the interview actually, and they offered me the internship that day, asked me when I could start. It was a Friday afternoon in August, so I could start on Monday. Left there, I was sky high. Called home, told the parents, called my friends, I'm working at the NHL, got this internship, pays me $10 a day. And my mom said, well, where are you going to live? I had no clue. We spent that weekend living in the bus terminal, the Port Authority bus terminal. Is anybody from New York? Any New Yorkers here? Port Authority bus terminal looks nothing like it does today. It didn't look anything like that 20 years ago when I was there. All the Disney stores and those things that were replaced, that replaced other kinds of entertainment that used to be around the Port Authority bus terminal. But anyway, I spent the weekend in the Port Authority bus terminal. Occasionally, I'd try to get into the Marriott Marquis lobby and sleep on the heating register. Picked up a newspaper, found a cellar about an hour away that somebody was willing to rent out. It had a toilet, a stand-up shower, and a sink, and got my start. My first week on the job at the NHL offices, I contacted the New York Rangers, the New York Islanders, and the New Jersey Devils offices. Asked if there was any type of volunteer work I could do, any type of intern type work I could do, game night operations work, and I was able to do game night work for all three teams. They usually paid me about $30 or $35 a game. The work varied. It was was able to do statistics for visiting radio or television broadcasters. Lots of times it was just handing out press notes or doing a lot of those types of things on a night-to-night basis. But it gave me a big advantage for a couple of reasons. One, I saw more than 100 hockey games live that year. Two, I was actually introduced to the world of networking. And that was something going through undergraduate school I never realized. But the network I was able to build doing that for that year. And three, let's not forget about this, I actually got a free meal in the press room every night, which is pretty good for somebody who's making about 10 bucks a day. But my networking opportunities were real important. I did that for a little more than a year, and then accepted a position through somebody I met that year, a gentleman by the name of Pat Hickey, who was a former player for the New York Rangers, who had become the general manager of a minor league team in New Haven, the New Haven Nighthawks. It happened to be the same year that Wayne Gretzky was traded from the Edmonton Oilers to the LA Kings, and the Nighthawks were the top farm team of the LA Kings. So the timing was real good. Most importantly, I was able to gain experience at a minor league level that I wouldn't have been able to get at another level. And the reason why, one, there's very few staff people in a minor league operation as opposed to maybe an NHL team or a Major League Baseball team. So what I was able to do was everything. I did everything from write press release to sell season tickets to put together advertising for our program, schedule a travel for the team, you name it. It was six of us that worked in the office. Tremendous experience. The other thing I did while I was there, well, other than the occasional theater here and there, the other thing that I did there is I went to graduate school, like many of you are doing here, and I was able to get my master's degree in 2 years while I worked in New Haven. When my 2 years were up over in New Haven, and by the way, I think the first year my salary in New Haven was $12,500, and the second year I had a $2,500 raise and I made 15 grand. So like many of you, the loans were mounting, they were building up. And although I loved what I was doing, I knew at some point in time I was gonna have to make some real money. I was losing girlfriends. I didn't have time, I didn't have money. Anyway, about the end of my second year in New Haven, I received a telephone call from the National Hockey League. National Hockey League was attempting to do a few different things. The NBA had just come out with its All-Star Weekend concept. It was the infancy of the slam dunk competition and the three-point shot competition and all those types of things, where the NBA was ahead of the curve and they took an All-Star game, which had pretty much become mundane, boring, that people weren't interested in, and found other ways to create sponsorship opportunities and events that were interesting to TV, to viewers and fans, but most importantly to corporate sponsors so they could raise money. The NHL saw this and wanted to do something similar. They hired me, and my job was to create an All-Star weekend for the National Hockey League, very similar to what the NBA was doing. So the first thing I was able to do was come up with a skills competition, which is actually still around today in various forms, that involved the fastest skater, the hardest shot, something they call the breakaway relay, which is basically a penalty shot competition, and all those types of things. The second part of the event that I came up with actually led into something much larger, and that was a game between the old-timers. The old-timers from the city that the All-Star game was being held, like for instance in Boston, it would be the Boston Bruins alumni team, against a group of former stars from other teams around the league. This eventually turned into the National Hockey League Alumni Association. Prior to that time, there was no alumni association. And it's turned out to be a great thing for all the former players, particularly, again, for networking, for job opportunities. It's amazing how many players in all sports, other than the ones that really have successful careers, and they're few and far between, regardless of what people think, other than those few players, most of them are out there and they're looking for work. And I've got roommates that were the same way. I've got one roommate, he had a 12-year NHL career, won a couple of Stanley Cups, but he can't get a job in the real world today because he doesn't have skills. He doesn't have skills. Sure, he's got a college education, but he sits down in front of an employer, and an employer asks him, you know, what kind of experience do you have? And he says, well, I play center and right wing. Well, sorry, I need somebody that's got sales experience or marketing experience or other administrative skills that are going to help people in business. Just a point of interest. I spent a couple of years actually traveling around with the NHL. What I would do is I would live in the city where the upcoming All-Star event was going to be. So I spent a year in Philadelphia, spent a year in Pittsburgh, spent a year in Chicago, and then actually was put in the Montreal office for good at one point in time. And my role expanded beyond the All-Star events to things such as the NHL entry draft, the Stanley Cup finals. And the idea was to try to make these events, as opposed to just a game, instead of just being a championship game. How do we do things to raise more revenue, to raise more excitement and interest, and to get ourselves on the national stage, or even the international stage when it comes to hockey? Spent a few years doing that, and eventually our commissioner at the time, he's then called the president, John Ziegler, was leaving office, and Gary Bettman, who's the current commissioner of the National Hockey League, was coming into place. He was based in New York, and I had always had this dream of going to law school. So I thought there was no time as the president, or at least at that present, to put myself together, start to study for the LSATs, prepare myself, and apply to law school in New York with the hope of transferring to the National Hockey League offices back in New York, and then going to law school at night in New York. New York was where I wanted to go to law school. At the time, I was living in Montreal, Quebec. Funny story, I'm in Montreal studying for this on my own. I didn't take any courses to prep for the LSAT. Studied on my own, took the LSATs at McGill College in Montreal. And after 3 or 4 months of studying, I walked in on a snowy day in December to take the LSATs. I sat down for them. And they handed out the booklets. Of course, you can't open them until they tell you. And then they said, begin in French. What an idiot. I've been in Montreal, French Canada, for 2 years, and I think they're going to give me my exam in English. So I took the LSATs in French. True story. Did okay. Applied to law school in New York, and then transferred to New York and worked out of the NHL office in New York for 3 more years. I was able to get my law degree from St. John's University, which is in Queens. Again, not to toot my own horn, but you know, there were great sacrifices to make. My typical day at that point in time, I'd get up 5:30, 6 o'clock, get dressed, I'd take a bus to the train, and take the train into the Manhattan. I was living out in Long Island because it was closer to the school. And then get on the subway to the office, put in a full day. I'd be out of there by just about 4:15, do everything in reverse, rush off to class. My classes started at 6:25 every evening at St. John's. I'd be in class till almost 11 o'clock. I'd go to the library till about 2, 2:30, whenever they'd kick me out, go home and do it all over again. So that's my law school experience. Any lawyers in here? One? So you know, law school is no fun. Did that, like I said, until I was able to get my law degree. My last year of law school, I was offered an opportunity to go work for the New York Islanders. Took a position with the New York Islanders as assistant general manager and director of hockey operations. Spent about 5 years there. In 5 years, we had 4 different owners. The team was sold 4 different times in the 5 seasons I was there. To say it was a tumultuous 5 years would be kind. But at the end, I had a run-in with my boss at the time, the general manager, Mike Milbury, who's still there in another capacity, over a player. And I'll tell you this story just because I think it's real important for some other things we'll talk about later. But we had made the playoffs for 8 seasons in New York, and I had the ability to acquire a player, Alexei Yashin, from the Ottawa Senators. Now, Mike Milbury, my boss, was interested in acquiring another player who was playing for Boston at the time. And the deal I was able to strike for Alexei Yashin was a much better deal than the deal he was able to strike for this other player. At the end of the day, a long argument pursued. This was at the NHL draft in Florida. and we went way into the early morning hours arguing about this. Our scouts finally supported me, and he told me to go make my trade. I went and made my trade. The next day at the entry draft, he decided to just go home because he was all upset that his deal didn't get done and mine did. So we went home. So later that day, I called Buffalo and I traded for Michael Packer too. That really infuriated him. But when I got back to New York, we were all over the newspapers for the first time in 8 years. The season ticket sales guys took me to dinner every night. They never sold tickets so easily as they did. And long story short, the team made the playoffs for the first time in 8 years, and I was fired. So it's the nature of the business, but it also teaches you a lesson. You've got to do what's right. You've got to put everything else aside, including your own job security and your own insecurities, and you've got to make the right decision, and you've got to make the right decision for your business, regardless of what the pressures may be from above you or below you or outside of the organization or inside the organization. You've got to do the right thing. Because I believe if you do the right thing in the end, you'll always be rewarded. It may be somewhere else, but you'll always be rewarded. Your reputation will precede you. Finished my career with the Islanders. I decided at that point in time I wanted to start my own law practice. I moved to Florida where I had bought a home. I was just outside the Tampa area. I was in Tampa, Florida, and I decided to get into the business of basically brokering the sale of professional sports organizations. I would find sellers who were looking to sell their team and put them together with buyers, or I'd have buyers approach me that were looking to buy teams in all different sports, and I'd put them together with the folks that were looking to sell their teams. Basically a real estate broker for pro sports teams. There was nothing really of that sort at the time. And as I was doing it, things really took off. I mean, especially in the hockey world where I was well known by a lot of people that own teams. I had been through that with the Islanders where our team was sold in 4 or 5 years. I was able to, as an attorney, do all the due diligence work and all the paperwork as far as the contracts for sale and whatnot. And it was an easy thing for people who were looking to buy or sell teams. Did a few of those things, and then I was approached by the Florida Panthers. And Florida Panthers asked me if I would come work for them. At the time, their president was a gentleman by the name of Bill Torrey, who was a longtime president and general manager of the New York Islanders, prior to when I worked for the Islanders, but a Hall of Famer in the hockey world, and asked me to come down and help their organization out. They had some issues. They just actually changed ownership, and they were going through a time where they needed some help. So I went to the Florida Panthers. I spent 2 seasons there as their director of hockey operations and legal counsel. And by the way, I throw all these titles at you. If you don't know already, when you get out in the real world, nobody really cares what your title is. It's not that important. It's all about the work. It's all about the work for you people. It's all about what type of work you're doing. Do you enjoy it? Is it challenging? And it's all about what kind of work you can do for other people. They don't care what you call yourself or what they call you or what it says in a media guide or in some business newspaper. It doesn't really matter. And, you know, and keep that in mind too. Spent 2 years with the Florida Panthers. The NHL was about to go into labor discussions with the union, which ended up being in a lockout a couple years back, and there was no hockey for a year. I saw that coming. I saw it as a good opportunity to try something else, and I had an opportunity to work as the commissioner and president of the North American Hockey League. North American Hockey League is a junior level league. It's for players who are beyond the high school or the mid-level hockey players who are looking to hopefully play in college or perhaps professionally. And this is sort of the bridge from one level to the next for these types of players. It's also something that's really a step behind in the United States more than anywhere else. So I was able to grow this league into a 20-team league. We stretched as far northwest as Alaska, where we had 2 teams, down through the southwest into New Mexico and Texas, and then up towards the Midwest and out into the northeast. My last season there, we had over 100 players for the third consecutive year get college scholarships to hockey, to universities that had hockey programs. We had, I think, 8 players drafted by NHL teams my last year as well. Again, the goal, a little bit different than junior hockey in Canada, was for players to advance and get themselves where they could get a college education, hopefully on scholarship, and then perhaps play pro. Where the junior leagues in Canada, for those of you who may not know, typically these kids are making decisions at 15 or 16 years old to go into junior hockey, but what they do under NCAA rules is they forego their NCAA eligibility. So if they don't make it to the NHL or to pro hockey by the time they're 18 or 19, it's over for them. So I spent three seasons working for the North American Hockey League as its president and commissioner. Our offices were in Dallas, Texas. And then last summer I had been approached by a couple of teams to interview, NHL teams to interview for general manager's positions. I did go on those interviews, and then actually the two teams that I had final interviews with, the Ottawa Senators and the Pittsburgh Penguins, hired two friends of mine, and one was Ray Shearer, who was the assistant general manager here in Nashville with the Predators. When that opened up, both teams had called me and offered me their positions, the positions that had been vacated with those clubs. I chose Nashville. I think it's a good organization. It seems like a great town. I've only been here for about 8.5 or 9 months, and I think there's a lot of work to do with the Predators on and off the ice to hopefully keep the team here. That's my background. I guess it's a little humbling to think that I could give it all to you in about 20 minutes. I thought I did some pretty good stuff. Anyway, and again, feel free to ask questions, any of these types of things, because I'm here for you people to hopefully help you make some decisions and get you where you want to go in whatever business or whatever career that you know that you seek to have. So, you know, you're not going to interrupt me. Don't worry. The next thing I'll talk to you about is some of the issues that face not only the Predators but the NHL, and try to give you some of my ideas that are a little bit unique and maybe get you to think a little bit outside the box about hockey, how it's marketed, how it's sold to the fans, how it's broadcasted, and what maybe could be done a little bit differently to hopefully raise the level of awareness of the sport, and also raise the number of fans that we have currently, and especially in this country, but also in North America and the world. I'll talk a little bit about the NHL first. Hockey fans, any hockey fans in here? Okay, so you're pretty familiar with the NHL. I mean, typically for years, and even today, I think the NHL is probably thought of as fourth on the ladder of the four major sports, as they call them. Now, apologize to NASCAR fans or anybody else, but essentially, in America, we talk about football, baseball, basketball, and hockey. For some reason, hockey's always been on the fourth. I think the biggest reason is because in the greater part of this country for years, and until about 10 years ago, the sport just wasn't played. It wasn't played by youngsters. It wasn't played by adults, and there weren't teams in a lot of areas in this country, particularly in the Southeast, in the Southwest, and even in the Far West, other than in the LA area, which has had a team for about 35 years. That's one problem the sports have in this country, is exposure. The second one you'll always hear is that the league has no national television contract, that people can't see it. They've got to search around to try to find a hockey game on TV. I think there's a little something to that that maybe the league doesn't admit. And I don't think the NHL or the hockey community has done the sport justice on television. First of all, and if I asked you, do you watch hockey on TV? What would you say?
Sometimes.
No, sometimes. If I said, why don't you watch hockey on television, what would you tell me? No, speak up.
It's hard to find it.
Hard to find
it. A special package. I said it's not on.
It's not on. But let's say you can watch a game. There's a game that's on. Why don't you enjoy watching it?
I don't think it's as exciting as TV. So
why?
Why? Can't hear it.
We miss
a lot of the personal interaction.
A lot of us
can't see the puck, right?
Yeah, that's one reason. A lot of us being interested in other sports don't really even know what's going on at hockey.
Yeah. Right, because you want to promote, and that goes back to the first problem. We haven't educated, we haven't done a good job of educating people about the sport. So they understand the sport, understand the rules, understand the nuances, because you can fight in hockey. It's not legal, you're penalized for it, but there are good fights in hockey. People have to understand that. When it comes to broadcasting the sport, the biggest criticism I hear from everybody, and I've heard it for years, is you can't see the puck on TV, right? Does everybody agree? Any baseball fans in here? All right. Anybody like the Yankees? All right. How fast does Roger Clemens throw his fastball?
90 miles an hour, easily.
Can you see that ball?
Nope.
Then how do you know where it's going?
It goes the same place in a case game.
Well, because you know the game, right? You're educated on the game. You know that when Roger Clemens winds up, throw a pitch, he's throwing it to the catcher, right? When a guy hits a fly ball to center field, what does the TV camera do? Put it on the ball in the air? You see a ball in the air? No, what does it do? Exactly, puts it on the center fielder getting ready, Palmer's mitt getting ready to catch it. And subconsciously, what does that tell you? The ball's going to center field. You can't follow a baseball either. But the people that broadcast baseball games understand the sport. The people that watch baseball games have a better understanding of the sport. So they know when Roger Clemens throws the ball, he's throwing it to the catcher. Right? When there's a guy on first base and the guy hits a ground ball to the shortstop, the cameraman knows he might throw it to the second baseman to turn a double play, or he might just throw it to the first baseman. So that producer in the truck says, put camera one on second base and put camera two on first base and we'll watch what happens and I'll cut to the right camera. They don't do that when they broadcast hockey in this country. You know why? Because the guys that are working those cameras and the gals that are working those cameras and the women that are the producers and the men that are the producers and the directors, they don't know the sport, and they just got finished doing a baseball or football game, and the network that spends millions of dollars for an NHL contract doesn't put anything into educating these people that actually broadcast the games. I'm not talking about the play-by-play and the colored people. I'm talking about the blood and guts of broadcasting a sporting event. The camera people, the producers, and the directors, they have to understand the sport. If they don't understand the sport, they can't predict what's going to happen, and they can't show it to you, the viewer, in the best light. Does that make sense?
So were you a fan of the glow puck that they had on TV a few years ago?
Absolutely not. And I was working at the NHL then, and I actually worked on the Fox broadcast. That's when Fox Television had the broadcast, and I'll tell you why. What is that? Does everybody know what we're talking about? Fox Television got the National Hockey League television contract in 1994. It was right when Gary Bettman became commissioner. They had the national deal. Fox was getting into all sports, baseball at the time, football. I mean, they were the big thing. Rupert Murdoch and everything that was going on the West Coast, they got the hockey television contract, nationwide contract, and they listened to what we were just talking about. Can't see the puck, can't see the puck. So what do? They put a trail on the puck, right? What does the trail on the puck tell you?
Where the puck is.
What?
Just keep following the puck, but you don't see the players.
No, all the trail on the puck does is tell you where the puck was. Right? I shoot the puck into that corner over there, and there's a trail behind it. The puck's over there, the trail's going this way. How did that help the viewer? Millions of dollars they spent on developing a glowing puck. And then they came up with the next thing. Then they told you how fast it went. Like that was really going to interest you, the viewer. Right? Now I know where the puck was, and I know that it went 100 miles an hour. Of course, I just missed a goal, because I was looking at this trail and trying to find out how fast it went. These were all educated, brilliant business people that came up with these ideas. Right?
Someone might even been in your class.
But that's why I don't like the glowing puck, and I don't like those types of things. I don't think people think logically when they look at the sport of hockey. I don't think they think logically. And unfortunately, it's the important people. It's the important people. The people that have a responsibility of bringing games to the casual fan, or the people that want to view it on television. So that was one mistake, you know, those are definitely big mistakes. The other mistake that the NHL made was chasing a national TV contract when twice before they've been on ESPN. Nothing's been better for hockey than ESPN. Why?
If you're watching sports, you just turn to ESPN.
Absolutely. Let's face it, okay? I consider myself a relatively intelligent person, okay? But the first thing I do in the morning when I get up is I put SportsCenter on. When I'm brushing my teeth, I can hear SportsCenter. And you know what? And if I'm there for more than an hour and I've seen it all, I'll watch the next SportsCenter too. Most guys and girls do that. And girls do it too, don't tell me they don't. It's more fun than watching CNN. The NHL twice has had contracts with ESPN, and in their haste to chase network television deals, they've sort of cast ESPN aside. But you go into, you have a question?
It's a bit of a diversion.
Go into, I know you guys don't go to bars, but when you were in undergraduate school, and Thursday night you went out to a bar, I know you weren't really watching TV while you were there, but what was on every TV in the place? ESPN. 90% of the bars in this country, all they do is, when they show up for work, at whatever time they show up for work, they turn the lights on, they put the TVs all on ESPN, and then they go to work, and it just stays on ESPN all night. With the question.
Can you talk a little bit about the number of games that's played each season and kind of the pros and cons of that as opposed to making it more of a rare commodity and playing fewer games?
Okay.
What are the thought processes behind that?
Okay, well, the thought process behind more games, and it's not necessarily the right one, but it's more games, more ticket sales, more money, more revenue, right. Blah, blah, blah. Nobody has a setup that football. Football's got the perfect setup. It's just the nature of the sport, right? I mean, I've seen tickets to Miami Dolphins. Is there any Dolphins fans in here? No, I didn't think so. I've seen tickets to Miami Dolphins. I don't even get to Miami Dolphin games. Maybe I get to one in a year if I have a chance or happen to be passing through. But and I have pretty decent seats. It costs me about $800 for two seats for an entire season. $800. The games are always on the weekend. So if you have children, you don't have to worry about it being on a school night, getting up early the next morning. It's almost always on a weekend. It's always an event. You go there, you tailgate, you barbecue, you have a couple of beers, you go to the game. You know the other thing the NFL does? They time their games. Unless there's overtime, NFL games last just under 3 hours. Next time you watch. I was in NFL productions one time. So there's a friend of mine who actually used to work in broadcasting with the NHL works. And prior to that, worked for NBC. Works for NFL productions now. I sat there on Sunday with him. And I think there were six, maybe even seven games. So we're all starting at the same time. You know that all seven kickoffs happen within like 25 seconds. For the most part, they're scripted. NFL games are scripted.
What effect do you think the salary caps have on like small market teams versus, I mean, I guess you've worked with both types of teams. It's obviously
Let me get to that next. But I don't know if I completely answered your question.
I guess my point, I hear what you're saying, I understand that the reason that they have more games for the revenue purposes, but then you hear about the sponsorship problems and the ticket problems, and so I guess my question is, I understand what the business model was to begin with, but it doesn't really seem like it's translating into that, particularly for the Predators, from what I've read, not sort of in-depth knowledge on it. And so I'm kind of wondering, right, if that was the strategy, is it changing now? Or is there still pros and cons maybe we're not seeing that the number of games is hopefully going to lead to?
I think that, well, first of all, you're right on. But I don't think you're going to ever see teams take a step back in the number of games they play. For instance, right now in the American Hockey League, which is the top development league below the National Hockey League, and I'm on the board of governors for that league, and we're trying to reduce the schedule of games from 80 to 72. Now the NHL plays 82 regular season games. Can't do it. Teams fight it. Now, even though in that league in particular, and even for the Predators, it's a good example for the Predators, in October, November, even in December, can't sell tickets. People don't want to go to those games. Not in the non-traditional hockey markets. People here don't want to go to Predators games, face it, in October, November. They go to football games or they watch football on television. You know, maybe it'll take a championship or two, or maybe it won't. Maybe it'll be that way. My own feeling is that if we won the Stanley Cup this year, that next October we'd have our first home game, the place would be sold out, it would be great, and then the next home game we had, it would be back to 11,000 people there, because UT's on TV against, or Vandy's on TV, or the Titans have a game. So you're right, the smart thing to do would be to cut down the number of games, not only from a business standpoint, but also from a competitive standpoint. These guys, they play too many games. It's too much wear and tear on their bodies. You know, hockey is I don't want to say it's every bit as physical as football, but it's pretty darn close. You know, when football players, they play a game and they get a week to recover. Hockey players sometimes play three games in 4 nights. So it would certainly be better. I mean, face it, that's your product out there, these players. These are the ones that you're investing millions of dollars, no different than doing research and development, right? Or any business or company. And yet you're busting them up like that. It'll just never happen though. You've got owners, especially of teams, who are just not going to give up the potential for more revenue because there's more games. They don't look at it and say, geez, we play 82 games and 41 of them are at home, and of those 41, there's 20 that I can't sell out. They look at it as, well, maybe if we come up with this gimmick or that gimmick, or maybe if our team catches lightning in the bottle and win the championship, we will sell out 41 of them. And if I don't have those 41, then I'm missing out on 10 games of revenue that I could have. But we all know only one team wins the championship every year. We just refuse to think that way. We've got a real educated bunch in hockey, don't we?
Can you speak a little bit to when you decided to start your law firm based on the buying and selling of sports teams? Can you speak a little bit to what kind of research you did to figure out that you'd be able to play in that market, that there was enough activity, and what kind of size of transactions you were going to go after? And then other than having an opportunity to go back into the NHL, why did you get out of that business and some of the reasons for that?
Okay. Looks like we have, 10 or 15 minutes? First of all, whenever this session ends, I'll make myself available informally outside if you want. So, I won't leave till all of your questions are answered and everything. And then he had a question first that I want to address, and maybe the way I'll address it is to talk about the last couple of things that I wanted to talk about to you before answering more, any more questions. You had asked me about salary cap and how that works. The NHL is a new collective bargaining agreement. This is the second season that it's been in place. It was necessary because the people that were running these teams were running them into the ground. The business was broken. Now, I'm not saying that that's to be blamed on the players, but any of you that know anything about labor negotiation, it's management versus union on everything, and it's always their fault. Anyway, the first problem the NHL had when it came to running their own businesses where they had morons running the teams. Who are the general managers of these teams? Anybody know? Former players. Most of which, a lot of them didn't even have high school educations, never mind college educations or business experience. Right? It makes no sense. I mean, look, everybody knows what 7-Eleven is? I go to 7-Eleven, I love Slurpees. Doesn't qualify me to be the CEO of 7-Eleven. Right? You've got mental midgets in charge of multi-million dollar businesses. And that's what was happening. Many of whom don't have the work ethic associated with being a business person. I'll give you a typical hockey player's day. Not that they don't work hard, not that they're not working on being physically fit and in shape to play. But they get up, 8:30, go down to the rink, we provide breakfast for them. They have to cook breakfast. Showers are optional in the morning. Show up, have a little breakfast, watch a little TV, chat with the guys, go out for practice. After practice, have lunch, watch a soap opera, or take a nap. On a game day, pretty much the same thing, only they take a nap instead of watching the soap opera, and then play at night. Their business clock is 9 to about 12:30. They don't understand, because they don't have the experience, they don't have the education, they're not good business people. And yet, they were running these teams for years. You're starting to see a change. And it started in baseball first. Any of you probably heard about the book Moneyball? I don't know if any of you read it. Pretty good book. But the point of Moneyball that Billy Beane is telling you is it's nothing that you don't learn in business school or law school. It's research, right? Putting in the time. It's understanding the odds. Working with statistics and making the best business decision based upon all your preparation and research. These guys just aren't fit to run teams. That's how hockey got into trouble in the first place. And starting to change, you're starting to see more people like myself, who have some background in the sport and playing the sport, but are more educated than just being a former pro player. The new CBA brought in a couple of things. One was the salary cap. The other thing was revenue sharing. The salary cap is quite simply a way to limit some of these guys that are running teams that don't know what they're doing. Sure, it levels the playing field. We still have teams like this year, Philadelphia, for instance, that's terrible. Phoenix is terrible. Anybody from Philadelphia? You know who's been running the Philadelphia Flyers for 30 years? Former player, Bobby Clark. They're the worst team in the league this year. They also used to have the highest payroll and be the worst team in the league before there was a salary cap. Right? Phoenix Coyotes, one of the other worst teams in the league, have one of the highest payrolls in the league. Who runs that team? Wayne Gretzky. Great player. Dumb businessman. So the salary cap is, to a degree, a theme of the playing field. But more importantly, it's a cost control measure. You know, the league can't go in and tell you what to negotiate, tell you what to spend on players. This is the closest they can come to without colluding. The second part is revenue sharing. The idea behind revenue sharing is to reward teams who do a good job by putting a competitive team on the ice, but also do a good job in the community when it comes to raising corporate sponsorship money, ticket sales, and the like. So that we don't have a bunch of teams out there that are doing just fine business-wise and a bunch of other teams that aren't healthy business-wise. But those are the two major points in CBA. And the revenue sharing, it's a very complicated formula. But I'll give you an example of the Predators. We had the largest revenue sharing piece last year, almost $16 million we received. And the reason why is because, number one, we field a competitive team. You have to make the playoffs. Number two, you've got to do a good job selling tickets and corporate sponsorship. You know, they're not just going to give you money, so you sit around and say, oh, well, forget it, we don't want to try to sell tickets, we'll just take the revenue share. You've got to be able to do both. So the ideal situation is what we had last year and what we should have again this year, which is a competitive team that makes the playoffs and has a low payroll. Our player payroll is third lowest in the league. It's about $38 million. The only two teams that are lower than ours are Pittsburgh and Washington. So that's the magic formula. The magic formula is to keep your payroll low. That's number one. Number two, do the best job you can at selling corporate sponsorship and tickets. And then number three, be competitive on the ice when you make the playoffs, because that's where you get more revenue. Since we're cutting it close, I want to talk to you guys about one other thing, and then perhaps you and I can talk about your question after. And that's, how do you get a job in sports? That's the one thing everybody asks me. And the thing I'll tell you is, you don't get a job in sports. Sports is only a career for a couple of people, players, coaches. The rest of us have business skills. Maybe we're lawyers, maybe we're accountants, maybe we're public relations executives, or sales and marketing executives, and we apply our skills and we apply our trade within the realm of sports. But it's really no different than any other business. A lot of the things I touched upon before, they might be comical in a way, but the principles are no different. I mean, if you wanted to just work in sports, then I would have told you, don't worry about going to graduate school. Don't worry about going to law school. You're wasting your time. You can get a job working for a sports team. There's plenty of them around. But what you want to do is you want to be an accomplished business person in whatever field interests you, or whatever field that you may be good at. And then if you happen to be able to apply it in the sports world, and this will get more to when I answer your question, all the better, that's great. But the most important thing is that you're the best lawyer that you can be, that you're the best accountant that you can be, that you're the best marketing professional you can be, that you're the best business person you can be. Because sports is a business, just like any other business. The one thing that's really interesting to me is all these schools, universities, and colleges around the country now, they all have these sports management programs. And I see all these 16, 17, 18-year-old kids that are getting ready to college, and I'm going to go to that school. I'm going to go in there and think, it's sports management. What a great major that'll be. I'll drink beer, I'll watch ESPN, and when I get out, I'll get a job as a GM somewhere. Come on. Vanderbilt University, just like every other university in the country, is what? It's a business, right? Sure, they're here to give you a great education and all the other stuff that you read in those brochures that they hand out. But it's a business. This university, like every other one in this country, is a business. So what are they doing? They're marketing. They're marketing and they're advertising to prospective students. Because every one of those kids that says, oh, I got a sports management degree, fills out an application, sends it in with his $150 or her $150 application fee. So they get more application fees because it's the hot thing. Kids are interested in this. Sports. As soon as they see the word sports in it. You know, a lot of them have graduate programs now, these sports management. You know, get your master's degree in sports management. Same type of thing. And then they get there, and what do? Instead of taking advertising, they take advertising in sports. Right? Public relations and sports. Sports law. If I hit you over the head with a hockey stick or a broomstick, it's still a tort, right? I'd be criminal. So you have to understand that. And most of you are beyond that now. I mean, you're in graduate school. But understand what universities are doing.
They're businesses. They're trying to attract them.
And even better, the kids that actually are accepted to that university and then go there for 4 years, or in some cases 5 or 6, and all the money they spend there, good business. Trust me, they could come up with a major for sex. They probably would. So, to digress for a minute here, be the best at what you can be, whatever field that you choose, whatever you're interested in. If you have the opportunity to apply it within this realm of sports, that's great. But the problems you're dealing with are the same problems, the same fact patterns that you're going to have in any other business. The hypotheticals are just going to involve athletes, perhaps, or teams. You know, when I know I have 4 little nephews, and of course they love sports and stuff, and I don't see them very often. When I do, I try to help them with things, especially like one of them is doing division now in school. And so, you know what I do? I pull out the sports page and we do batting averages and things like that. It's amazing how much all of a sudden, boy, no problem with it. It's the same concept, just older. The other thing is, if you do want to apply your trade and your skill in sports, you've got to be flexible and you've got to be willing to make sacrifices. If you come to me and you say, I'm a marketing executive and I want to work for a team, but it's got to be a baseball team and it has to be in Boston. Well, guess what? You got one chance and it's probably one job there. And if it's filled, you're out of luck. And a lot of that has to do with the choices we have to make as we grow up. You know, we have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, we're married or we decide to get married, we decide to have children, we have children. All of a sudden, you know, I can't take that job with the Los Angeles Dodgers because my wife's got a great job here in Nashville. Or I want to work in sports, but I want to marry my longtime girlfriend first. You have to understand that every decision you make along the way in life is going to limit you in some way. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't make those decisions, but it's going to limit your opportunity. And there's only so many sports teams and leagues out there. And the more you limit yourself to a geographical area, the type of work you want to do, the more opportunities that'll pass you by. So the more open you can be, the more sacrifices you can make, the ability to in some cases, go to far off places and make little or no money. And I'm not saying that's the right decision, or it's not even a decision, maybe it's not even a decision you can make at this point in your life, but the more you can do those types of things, the more opportunities you'll have. Because again, right now in this age, sports is sexy. It's no different. Most other businesses, but it's got a sex appeal out there. It's got a sex appeal to young kids, it's got a sex appeal to prospective students, and it's got a sex appeal for people who want to get out of college or graduate school or law school or med school and think that this would be great. I've been looking for this. I put this off because after college I went to grad school or law school, and finally I found a job that I don't have to do any work in. Looks like we gotta wind it up. Anyway, thanks for having me.